Welcome to The Business of Medicine with Sharon Hollander. This is the show that reveals the behind-the-scenes secrets of healthcare. With the changing rules, regulations, and challenges facing healthcare, you can't afford to miss this information. Now, here's Sharon Hollander.
Good morning and welcome to the show. We're live today from Encino, so if you have any questions for our guest or myself or would like to join the conversation, our phone number here is area code 888-463-6748. Once again, that number is 888-463-6748. Today I have a very distinguished guest. His name is Gary Vautour and he is a healthcare advocate. He works with his own company called Fierce Advocacy. And he's going to join us today. He's got a master's degree in healthcare administration and a myriad of life experiences, including some personal tragic story that he's going to share with us and how he came to be an advocate and what that entails, and give our listeners some tips and tricks about what to do if they're facing a long-term hospitalization or large medical issues. Also, he's located in the South Carolina area, I believe, right? Anyway, good morning, Gary. Welcome.
Good morning. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. We had a little earthquake this morning to shake me up.
That's kind of typical, though, out there, right?
Yeah, it was small.
Yeah.
So, I apologize, but you're in the South Carolina area, right?
Columbia, South Carolina. Capital city right. Of South Carolina.
There you go.
Deep in a river.
So, welcome. Welcome, welcome.
Thanks.
So we've talked to other advocates before, you know, and everybody has their own perspective and their own way of doing things. But why don't you give us a little bit of history on how this came into your life?
I will. Back about 9 years ago, I was living in Massachusetts, central Massachusetts, just south of New Hampshire in a rural town. I worked in a nearby city for a university. I was a geographic information systems analyst, using remote sensing software to solve environmental problems, for the most part, and traveling, did a lot of travel with that job. My wife, Lynn, and I had been together for many, many, many years, and she was providing counseling to troubled teens through a service agency run by the state. One morning in March of 2005, she had a small car accident and hit some black ice on the road, and the vehicle rolled off to the side. And she was, you know, unharmed, but because it was a rollover, they did a routine x-ray of her neck at the local hospital that she was taken to, and they found a lesion in the second vertebrae of her neck that shouldn't have been there. So they sent her off to, next thing you know, I had driven in to meet her there, and the next thing we knew, we were in a helicopter going to a trauma center in a bigger city. And they held her for about a week and did a lot of tests and diagnoses and said, well, it's some kind of bone infection, and we're going to just see if it heals up on its own. And they sent her home in a hard collar for 6 months.
And at that time, was she sick or she wasn't sick?
No, she had no symptoms. Nothing had changed in the 6 months. And we were a little frustrated by them keep saying that they didn't know what it was. So we headed into Boston with referrals from our primary care physician and went to Dana-Farber and then eventually to the Brigham, which are two big hospitals in Boston. They did a needle biopsy and determined it was a form of bone cancer called chordoma, which only affects 1 in about 500,000 people. It's a congenital birth defect, and it's invariably fatal within a few years after it.
Wow.
So they told
us. But the thing is, being congenital, like she had it since she's a baby, but it didn't manifest itself until. Do you think it was there the whole time
accident.
In the car accident? Pardon?
By accident, because of an accident.
Yeah.
So she was non-symptomatic. It hadn't left the bone of the vertebrae. Eventually, what they said would happen would be within a few years, it would infiltrate into her spine and travel up to her brain. And she'd be terminal shortly thereafter, or else the vertebrae would weaken to the point where it would just collapse one day. They said that most chordomas are found post-mortem, rarely like this, you know. And so we thought, well, that's a sign, you know, God's on our side. He helped her get this far,
Now, it showed up, though, on an x-ray, right?
Yeah, it showed up.
Not to make me paranoid or anything.
Yeah, well, it showed up in an x-ray. They did PET scans. You know, during that 6 months, we weren't idle. They did a PET scan, and she had multiple areas of uptake, as almost anybody that has a PET scan would. They biopsied those areas, like her kidney and her chest, and they found no cancer there. So it hadn't metastasized or moved into other cells in her body or anything like that. We found quickly, once we got out to Boston, that nobody even heard of this cancer. I mean, you talk to the cancer specialist at Dana-Farber, and they say, get right back to you, and they'd run to the web, and they type chordoma in Google.
That's pretty scary.
Yeah, and that wasn't very comfortable. And then we found an orthopedic oncologist at the Brigham who said, you know, I've dealt with this once or twice in my career. I read literature on it. The only thing we really can do is to try to remove it. Because it's right next to the spine, you can't do radiation. Chemo isn't effective on bone cancers like this that are encapsulated by the bone. The chemicals can't get to it. So we said, okay. And he backed out shortly after because of the complexity of the surgery and handed us over to a neurosurgeon at the Brigham who explained to us that although she hadn't done the surgery before, she could, she had researched it and she had done similar type surgeries, and that she could remove the second vertebrae from Lynn's neck intact through the back of her throat, and that would eliminate the chance of her having this cancer. So Lynn gave consent, and about 7 months after the car accident, we went into surgery at the Brigham. It turned into a two-week-long process, just the surgeries. Everything was more complicated than they thought it was going to be.
It usually is, right?
Yep. During the second half of the surgeries, the last day of surgeries, basically, and everything should have been clear sailing. You know, she had been awake and functioning fine between the surgeries and all of that. She suffered two different strokes during the surgery. And she lost over a third of her brain because of the oxygen being cut off to it, the blood flow. It left her paralyzed with nothing but the use of her right arm. Because the surgery was so invasive, it literally meant going through the back of her throat. She had speech and swallow problems and couldn't speak and couldn't eat. And they told me she wasn't going to survive this, that people rarely survive strokes like this. Yeah. And I moved from the waiting room where I had been for the last couple of weeks into the ICU with her. And I spent the next 12 weeks living next to her in the ICU while she tried to recover. She woke up about a week or two into it, and I knew she was still there because, you know, you can tell when you've been married to somebody for 20-some-odd years, you know, when they're with you, you know.
Yeah.
And she wanted a pen, and we gave her a pen and a paper in her right hand, and she wrote in these little teeny letters, what's wrong? And, you know, we had decided we weren't going to tell her right away because we needed to get her stable. And,
right.
But you're going to be fine. You had some complications. And the next thing she wrote was bullshit.
I'm no kidding, right?
I coughed a few minutes ago, and my entire left side didn't move. Tell me what's wrong. So we told her. And the next thing she wrote was, take me home. Don't let me die here. And that basically became my marching orders for the next 5 months. We progressed through the ICU with a lot of complications that we probably shouldn't have had to endure. We went to rehab, back into the hospital, back to rehab. And eventually, in July of 2006, we got home. And we had converted pretty much the first floor of our house into an ICU so that we could do home care there. We widened doors, roll-in showers, overhead lifts, redundant power, suction, all of that.
Such a horrible story. But, I mean, not to get, like, morbid more than necessary, but...
You know, it's because this is what shaped me, you know. I got medical experience doing this. I managed her home care for the next 3 years. Right? You know, we gave her a great life. You know, she was very appreciative. She recovered her ability to speak and swallow. But there are some strokes, some effects of strokes that you just can't recover from.
You know? Right.
She got rid of the trach, but she'd always need a feeding tube, you know. And and things like that, and she understood that. And she was with us the whole time. We had physical therapy and occupational therapy and speech and swallow therapy the whole time. You know, our visiting nurse association was wonderful. You know, her old primary care physician started coming into the house once a month on his day off, you know, to do her wellness checks and stuff. And we went almost 3 years with zero complications in home care land, which is phenomenal, you know. After all that time, Lynn decided, she was talking with her therapist and decided that, you know, her pain levels kept increasing and we had to keep matching it with pain meds. And then there were some signs that maybe they hadn't gotten all the cancer. And she said, you know what, I'm not going to go through this again. You know, and she decided to stop eating and drinking, and she instructed us to turn off the feeding tube. So we moved from home care to hospice for about 2 weeks until she passed. Mm. I'm honored to have been there with her. You know, it's rare that we're allowed to show how much we care about somebody. You know, and I was able to be there with her right to the end. I didn't do well after that. My entire life had become built around making her survive, you know. And it took me about a year before I realized I needed to make this meaningful for me. And that's what I decided, well, you know, there were a lot of steps along the way where we made mistakes. And people could have helped us, but it wasn't any of their jobs to help us with those things. It wasn't anybody's job to help us find a second opinion. It wasn't anybody's job to help us when we were inpatient, to advocate for us, to try to improve our outcomes. It wasn't anybody's job to know, figure out what her advanced wishes were beforehand. So that's what I started looking into advocacy for. Realized that I needed a degree. I needed to understand how hospitals worked. So I went back to school, got my master's degree in healthcare administration, and started Fierce Advocacy a couple of years ago. And now what I try to do is simple. I'm trying to be the person that wasn't there for us back in 2006 that we so desperately needed and didn't know we needed.
Now, in your opinion, though, it seems like it's an up-and-coming trend right now. Like,
yeah,
people are more aware of the need for an advocate, or that there's more people cropping up as advocates, right?
Absolutely. I think with the Affordable Care Act and the increase in insured people, we're seeing a demand that's been unheard of before on hospital services and doctors, the healthcare industry as a whole. I mean, it accounts for such a huge portion of our economy already, you know, and this is definitely increasing it. But there's also a shortage on their side of staff and resources. I think we're going to see that exacerbated over time. And that's leading to less focus on patient safety than there should be. And that's where the need for advocates is coming in. Plus, there's the web. The web is making every potential patient more knowledgeable and more informed.
And that could be a good or bad thing, depending on.
Yeah, it can be. I've run into situations where a little knowledge is a dangerous thing, you know, where people tend to overdiagnose themselves and drive their doctors crazy with 17 different theories about why they're sick when it's just the flu, you know. But it also, if we had had the wealth of resources we have now in terms of the web, back in 2006 even, it probably would have made a difference in which decisions we made. We probably would have gone to a second opinion. Because we would have found now, I could find now, that there are facilities that had more experience treating this type of cancer.
Right. And so, but do you think, you know, without getting into specifics, that it could have been avoided? Like, if you had gone for a second opinion, you think that they would have told you not to do surgery?
It's one of my few regrets. You know, I know it was one of Lynn's few regrets that we didn't go to MD Anderson or John Hopkins to get a complete second opinion. There was no evidence the cancer had grown, and looking back at it now, with hindsight, of course, you know, which is always 20/20, there's every piece of evidence that this cancer was stable and that it may have never spread to her spinal cord, or it had been 10 years before it did, or 20. There's every piece of evidence that says the surgery that they attempted, and I use that word deliberately, was beyond me. Capability of surgical skill at that time and was almost inevitably going to fail. We didn't understand that then.
It looks like we have to take a short break, but when we come back, I want to hear more.
doctor, doctor, don't you whine, because your cash flow is now a flat line. You can make your income fast. Call 818-907-STAT.
For all your medical billing needs, visit us at www.statmedical.net or call 818-907-7828. That's
818-907-STAT.
Welcome back to the Business of Medicine on TalkZone. Here's Sharon Hollander.
Welcome back to the show. We're talking this morning with Gary Vautour, who is a advocate and runs a company called fierceadvocacy.com. And he was sharing with us his personal story on how it came to be that he decided to become an advocate. And so I want to talk to Gary. Also, just want to remind you that we are live. So if you have any questions, you can join the conversation at area code 888-463-6748. And we'd love to hear from you. So before the break, Gary, we were talking a little bit about how there's just a tremendous need right now for patient advocates. And so I kind of wanted to get your take on, you know, what defines an advocate and what are some of the areas that they get involved with and what patients need assistance with.
Mm-hmm. I had somebody ask me that. I get asked that all the time, you know, especially by hospital staff. They feel like, you know, social workers, for example, that they act as patient advocates. Nurses act as patient advocates. You know, and in a lot of ways they do advocacy, but they're not pure advocates in the vision that I have, you know. And I'm going to explain that. And I think when I'm done, you'll understand why I see the difference. The word advocate, you know, it's important to understand the origins of words sometimes, to understand what their meanings are. Back in, like, the 1300s, it was a Latin word, which was used to refer to legal counselors, which kind of confuses some people now. But before that, the French had the word advocare. The meaning of that is meant to call one's aid, call to one's aid. So if you needed help, you advocated, you called somebody to your assistance. And that's how I look at advocacy. I help patients by answering their call for assistance when they're hospitalized. If I understand your directives, I can help improve your outcome when you're hospitalized. You know, that's what's more important than anything else, is keeping patient autonomy intact during hospitalization when they can't exactly express themselves. You know, we see these patient bill of rights in hospitals all the time, okay? And they talk about the rights that patients have, you know, the right to high-quality care, clean and safe environment, protection of privacy, assistance with bills, insurance claims, preparation for patients and families for discharge. But the most important thing here is involvement in patient care. And in order to have somebody who's involved, they have to be knowledgeable. And unfortunately, science, medicine isn't a simple thing. It's very complicated. Doctors have a tendency to speak down to patients without even realizing they're doing it. Some doctors more than others, you know, they use their own terminology, and not always does a patient even understand what they're being told or what decisions they're making. A big part of this is the right to informed consent. A lot of times informed consent is treated as just a bunch of forms that you sign before surgery.
Right.
Actually, it should be a process where everything about the illness is explained to the person and the opportunity to ask questions is presented. And it's only when you're truly informed that you should be giving that consent. And rarely does that happen for major surgeries. I know in our case, you know, back when, we were just handed paperwork that said, you need to sign this. You know, and Lynn signed it. We never thought twice about what we were signing. You know, so when I get involved with somebody who's facing an event like what we did, I make sure that they have advanced directives. Right? Advanced directives are a set of specific questions designed to address issues like, if I'm comatose and I have no brainwave activity following a surgical mistake or an error or a disaster in the operating room, what degree of life support do I want? You know, this is the Karen Quinlan questions that support systems. Having advanced directives in advance doesn't mean you're anticipating the worst, but it does mean that you're prepared. You're preparing the people around you for the worst, so they don't have to try to guess what your decision would have been. I use a great set of questions called five questions out of the Southern Poverty Law Association, I think it is. If anybody has any questions about anything we're talking about, they can just email me, and I'll get back to them with the details. It's a questionnaire that's 6 pages long that asks questions like, if you're in the hospital for a long time, do you want, list the people that you would want to have visit you, you know, things like that. It goes into that level of detail. Would you want clergy present and praying for you if you were ill and couldn't wake up in the hospital? You know, and having all of those questions answered in advance for your family is critical for them to be able to, or for your advocate, to make sure that what's done is what you would have wanted done, you know, because the whole goal here is for you to wake up eventually, obviously, and come back to life and be comfortable with everything that's happened.
But wouldn't you say that it's true, though, that most patients think that the advocacy comes after the fact when they're dealing with their hospital bills?
Yeah. That's where a lot of the emphasis is now, because billing is such a complicated issue. It has become such a complicated issue that, I go see my doctor, you know, and I'll get a bill. Now, at this point, you know, I know that I don't have to pay that bill because my insurance is going to pay for it. And then they just send me the bill the same time they're sending my insurance company the bill. But if I make the mistake, like some people might, and actually send them the payment, and then my insurance company pays them, then I have to, if I find out about that, then I have to try to get that money back from the doctors, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's become so complicated for some people, you know, that they need professional help with that. It's become complicated on the other side as well for doctors and hospitals, or else companies like yours wouldn't exist.
You know, right.
Writing down their bills on the back of a notepad and sending it off to Medicare. It doesn't work that way anymore, you know.
I know. I'm the only one on the planet that gets excited when it's flu season.
Uh-huh. The same is true about advocacy. A lot of it, except for the way I view it, is I think it's becoming more and more proactive. Getting your advance directives done in advance is a good thing. I've had clients that didn't have anybody to hold their healthcare proxy while they were in the hospital, and I've done that for them. I can't do that if I don't know what they want me to do with that proxy. The proxy is the ability to make medical decisions for a person when they're unconscious. So if the doctor says, well, we need to put them on this medication.
Put them in a medical coma or something, right?
Right. The other things that advocacy can do once the hospitalization has begun is visits. Having somebody there that is actually only on your side. You know, when I go into a hospital visit, I'm there to support the family and the patient. I could care less what the hospital thinks about me. That's a unique perspective that's missing in medicine today. Nurses and stuff like that, they can be good advocates for patients, but they can't be a patient advocate because the word patient isn't there. Patient is the one that is the tail that wags the dog for me. I am only accountable to my patient. The patient is the head of the team, not the doctor, not the hospital. But the doctors and nurses, social workers, they're all getting a paycheck from the facility that you're in. And they have to be mindful of that fact. There's always going to be an inherent limitation on what a doctor can say about another doctor's treatment, or a nurse can say about a doctor, or what a social worker can explain to you that may lead to a malpractice lawsuit, for example. They're not going to be able to do those things if they want to keep working. So bringing a set of eyes from the outside that comes in and acts solely as a patient advocate who only works for the patient changes the equation.
And have you received resistance from hospitals?
Most of them don't even know I'm there.
Okay.
I don't announce my presence. I have the paperwork with my client, my advocate, all set up in advance so that if I need to, I can exert their autonomy. I come in as a friend, then visit during visiting hours. I sit with them, explain what I do sometimes, and ask to read a chart if I need to.
And they let you read the chart?
If I'm holding the proxy, they have to let me. Just as if the patient had asked.
Yeah, well, I've asked to read my chart, and it didn't go over too well. I just take it.
Just word fierce in my business name.
Yeah.
Sorry.
That's okay.
Yes, I'm not going to say that it's always easy. It's not. All right. But I don't go in there with an attitude of, you're going to do what I say. My attitude is, this patient has already told me what they want to have happen now, and I'm here to make sure that you agree to that. And do everything you can to make that happen with me. That more flies with sugar than vinegar all the time.
Right.
You know, rarely do I have to come in and do the finger.
Flex your muscles, yeah.
You know, occasionally, you know, and one of the services that I do offer as part of this is conflict mediation.
So, but what happens? I mean, like if you, you know, how are you going to determine if, let's say there was a medical error done? You know, we've heard all these horror stories, obviously, of people who go to the hospital and something terrible happens directly as a result of somebody's incompetence or, you know.
What I'm going to do is I'm going to help patient family members or the patient themselves ask the right questions. And then I'm going to be sitting there listening to the answers with them at the family conference and making sure the truthful answers are given. The truth is kind of elusive when it comes to some things like this sometimes. There's one way to say the truth, and there's another way to say the truth, you know. And both statements may be truthful responses, but only one of them is the actual explanation. Knowing the right questions can help shape that answer, define what actually occurred or is occurring in order to fix the problem, not to build a case for a future lawsuit. I haven't had a single advocate that has ever ended up in the hands of a lawsuit or at lawyers and going with malpractice lawsuits. That's a big part of what I feel I do, is I avoid the need for that by avoiding the things that cause them. Now,
which are usually miscommunication is what I've heard.
Absolutely. Transfer of records is one of the biggest problems I see. You'll get discharged from a hospital on your way to rehab. They have to do a discharge summary. It's a summary. It's two pages. You can't encapsulate everything that that rehab facility needs to know to get you back up on your feet in two pages. I'll look at the patient's chart before they leave with the doctor, for example, and act as sort of a transitional assistant so that when we get to the rehab and they're doing the intake, I can elaborate and make more examples, hold them more accountable to what the doctor meant by this sentence. That he.
Do you think with the implementation of electronic medical records that because most of the time they'll share medical records, right?
The records get transferred, but at the rehab facility, we could stick with this example. When you get to the rehab facility, they're only going to look at the summary. They've got 27 people they need to do intake for that day. You know, they're not going to go back and comb through the medical records. When we got to rehab after we had been at the Brigham, Lynn's medical records were almost 3 feet tall if you printed them out. There is nobody at the rehab facility that had the time to spend 5 days going through those and learning every detail about the case. But I knew every detail because I had been there through it. So when they had questions at rehab, I was the first person they asked. Was she ever on this medication? Nope. Why did she have this complication? I could explain that to them. You know, I do the same thing now for patients as much as I can, as much as I get involved. And I always let the patient determine what my level of involvement is. That's the most important.
Yeah, because, you know, obviously you have to protect their privacy and
absolutely
some other issues. It looks like that we have to take a short break, but we'll be back with more from Gary Vautour.
And now, more of the business of medicine on TalkZone.com. Here's Sharon Hollander.
Thank you, and welcome back to the show. We're live this morning on Thursday morning, and if you want to join our conversation or ask us any questions, the phone number is area code 888-463-6748. We're talking with Gary Vautour, who is a healthcare advocate located in Columbia, South Carolina, and he's talking to us today about what to look for if you're going to select an advocate and how his services have been beneficial to patients that have been in hospital situations or transferred to medical rehab facilities. So, Gary, before the break, you were talking about how it's really important to have the patient basically outline what their needs, wants, and desires are before they go into the hospital.
In my initial conversation with every single person that I develop a relationship with as an advocate, I explain to them that this is a team approach, that they are the lead person on this team, not me. The questions that they're going to have to answer up front are the ones that they may not be able to answer when they're in the hospital, and it's up to me to do that for them. They are the ones that are defining what degree of care they want and what decisions they want made for them. Always. You know,
I don't know if this has been your experience, but
like
a lot of times they'll ask patients, you know, the whole situation about whether they want to be resuscitated. But there's different levels, right, of resuscitation. Like a patient that chooses to have...
Just one thing, a DNR order, a do not resuscitate order, says that if your heart has stopped or your breathing has stopped, that no one will use machines to restart your heart or restart your breathing. I'm limited in what cases I can discuss as by way of example, and that's why I go back to Lynn so often, because I won't discuss what has happened with my advocates in terms of hospitalization. When she was breathing once or twice in the hospital and she had to be put on a ventilator, a doctor there suggested that it was time to turn the machines off and let her pass, that she had signed a DNR. You know, and I had to determine what she meant by that DNR. Right.
Uh-huh. Because it wasn't laid out. I mean, that's the thing. That's the issue, right?
Yeah.
Because, I mean,
proxy,
it's all or nothing.
No, you can't turn off the machine. She wouldn't want that. Until we know what she would want, you can't guess what she would want. And she was very appreciative of that fact later for the two and a half years that she was alive.
Right.
You know, she got to go home and get closure on a lot of things and see what progress she could make before she made her decisions about whether to continue living. It wasn't something that she had to decide in advance, nor should it be something you or I have to decide in advance. So having a DNR doesn't necessarily mean they have the right to turn everything off just because they decide to. That's not a good way to do things. We know by evidence, by survey, that not every doctor is honest. Okay, not every hospital.
Really?
Okay. In fact, I've got surveys in front of me of the yin yang that 10% of doctors do not completely agree with disclosing all risk and benefit of treatment right off the top. And
well, you know, in my book, Medical Billing Horror Stories, I found all kinds of doctors that, you know, intentionally committed fraud just to milk the insurance companies.
Cover themselves? Yeah.
Yeah.
Or, you know, vice versa. You know, they'll do it to avoid a potential malpractice. You know, in 2009, here's the survey I was talking about, 1,900 doctors, that's a huge survey size, the journal Health Affairs, which is a leading publication in medicine, did a survey of doctors. They found that one-third of physicians did not completely agree with disclosing serious medical errors to patients. One-fifth did not completely agree that physicians should never tell a patient something untrue. And two-fifths did not completely agree that they should never disclose their financial relationships with drug and device companies to patients. Only one-tenth said that they had told patients, and one-tenth of them said they had told patients something untrue in the previous year. That means a third of the doctors in that survey said they would hide an error. A fifth of them felt it was all right to mislead a patient regarding the truth, and a tenth of them actually admitted to lying to a patient within the last year.
It's unbelievable.
Where advocacy comes in. I think part of the problem in medicine, and I don't want to get too deep into this because I don't want to sound too condescending towards doctors. I mean, they're wonderful people. They do a hard job. But they've held patients' autonomies in their hands for so long, they've forgotten what it's like to give it back. You know, the days are gone now where we check into a hospital and we hand over all our rights and decision-making to people just because they have a white coat and a stethoscope. Now we can bring somebody with us that can actually speak their language. That's an advocate who can actually listen to what they're saying and explain it to us and put what we want in terms that those doctors can understand. That's the most important thing an advocate can do is act as that intermediary between the physician or the staff in a healthcare organization, any healthcare organization, and the patient. Not everybody understands complicated terms, you know. Literacy levels impact things greatly, you know, but most importantly, and this is one story I will share, sometimes you need somebody who can express your wishes in a way that a doctor can understand it and relate to get them to agree with you. A few months ago, I had somebody that was referred to me who lived out in the Midwest. Their friend said, you know, listen, Jonathan, we'll call him Jonathan, has cancer. He's been through several rounds of chemo and radiation therapy, and he just wants to go home now. And he is at the point where he's not interested in prolonging his life for another few months with another round of chemo. He wants to go home from the cancer hospital, And he had to self-discharge himself because the doctor refused to discharge him. The doctor won't order the home care services that he needs at home now. He's saying that
that's ridiculous because he's against medical advice.
I know. And he asked me to talk to the person, you know, and I gave Jonathan a call and I explained the situation, what I do and how I can help. And he asked me, he says, well, what can you do? I says, I don't really know. I obviously can't fly out to the Midwest to help you out. I'm not, haven't been involved in your case. You know, there's limits to what I can do. Let me call your doctor. And this is one of those times when I did bully a little bit.
Uh-huh. And the thing is, did the doctor, I mean, they took your call and everything, right?
Not initially.
Okay.
I had to be very persistent, and I had to say many, many times, that's okay, I'll wait until he's available. No, he will not call me back. You know, and they don't like you when you wait online, when you sit there and hang on hold. You know, eventually it took me a couple of days to get him on the phone, quite literally. When we did, you know, I said to him, I said, you know, I understand that you're going to pull the HIPAA card first thing. You're going to tell me that you can't discuss Jonathan's case with me. And I understand that. I'm not asking you to. I'm here to discuss Jonathan's wishes with you. And I said, and you're going to have to give me 15 minutes of your time and understand and think about what I'm saying. And that's all I'm asking you to do. And, you know, I explained to him what Jonathan wanted, you know, and he was not saying much of anything except, I said, well, you know, what I want you to do is this. I want you to look at the reasons that you're making this decision. And if those reasons are because you don't want to feel like you failed Jonathan, I want you to think about that. Because what Jonathan wants you to do is not what you're doing. And by not doing what your patient wants, you are failing him. I said, that's the first thing I want you to ask yourself. The second thing I want you to ask yourself is if you were Jonathan, what would you want?
And then what?
Anything.
What was his response to that?
And I said, well, you know, it's important that I understand that you understand what I'm asking you. If you were Jonathan and you were facing a terminal outcome in a few months, would you go through another round of chemo after seeing what the last two rounds have done to the quality of Jonathan's life? And he went, well, no, I wouldn't. And that's when I played one.
Yeah, duh, right?
What gives you the right to withhold the stuff that Jonathan needs now for the next couple of weeks at home because he didn't agree with you? When you wouldn't have even made that decision yourself? And he went, you know?
Oh, yeah, good point.
I never thought about it that way. An hour later, he had ordered home care and hospice for Jonathan. Jonathan passed about 5 days later. A mutual friend got in touch with me, and he said, you know, his family was there. He got closure with some of his family members he hadn't spoken to in a long time. You know, and about an hour before he died, my friend had visited, and he said, you know, Jonathan wanted me to let you know that he really appreciates what you did for him. See, that's when you know you're doing it right.
Yeah, of course, because, I mean, your background in hospital administration has helped you because...
Yeah, absolutely. I understand how hospitals work. I can speak finance with the finance people. I can speak ethics with the ethics committee. You know, I can speak transitional care with the patient care coordinators. I get all that, you know, and it comes across. You know, I realized before I started doing this, I needed letters after my name in order to get...
Yeah, well, that's unfortunate, right?
And actually, it's true. I couldn't be as good an advocate now if I didn't spend 2 years studying how hospitals work. I'd be a loose cannon. You know, I'd be acting emotionally instead of logically. And you've got to combine both if you're a successful advocate to do this job well.
Right. And the thing is, I mean, hospitals, they are a very unique organization.
And they're very...
Most doctors don't even know how hospitals work.
They're widely different, too. All right? But the bottom line is, hospitals are for-profit. Even nonprofit hospitals have to cover costs.
Right.
And lawsuits eat into costs. It eats into profit. No hospital wants any situation developing that could lead to a malpractice lawsuit. What I think is changing is that hospitals are going to start to believe and understand the reality of the situation, that when you have patient advocates involved that solely work for a patient, outcomes are improved. The chance of being sued for an error goes down because the error rate goes down. When that happens, they're going to save money on insurance.
Why does the error rate go down when you have an advocate?
Like a set of eyes. There's this thing called the observer effect. The people who know they are being watched from the outside do a better job. It's a known fact, and it's very pronounced in the medical community. It's one of the reasons that hospitals are so anti-surveillance, for example. If you could put a camera in every patient's room, step aside from the HIPAA regulations, step aside from the patient violation of patient privacy rights and all of that. If you had passive monitoring of care, there would be fewer errors and accidents because people would know that they were being recorded all the time. And their performance would be different. That's a known fact. It happens in every industry. That's why so many places have cameras. Right?
Yeah, but why can't hospitals have cameras? They have security cameras.
Right now, I think most people would be okay with it if they knew the intended purpose and use of it was to protect their safety and their rights. But hospitals won't like to do it because what they'll say is that it might violate the HIPAA rights of another patient. Okay? You got two people in a room, if you got a camera running, you know, that doesn't excuse people. Single rooms, obviously. Surgeons, for example, wouldn't want to have a camera running during every surgery, for the most part. Most surgeons wouldn't.
Unless they're plastic surgeons in Beverly Hills, and then they go on TV. They spend all their time on TV.
Yeah. Because of the whole malpractice lawsuit issue and all of that, I mean, mistakes are common in surgeries. But that doesn't mean that somebody did it on purpose. Errors happen in hospitals. It's a complicated place. If you've spent any time there, not as a patient, it's amazing that more errors don't happen than it is that errors do happen. Because there are so many different systems running. You know, there's the systems that bring food to the table, the doctors themselves, the nurses, the cleaning staff, the food staff, the medicines that have to be delivered and administered to patients, the care that has to be given to complex cases. You know, all of those things have to mesh perfectly for a hospital to run perfectly and not have any problems or errors. That's not likely to happen in most cases.
And obviously the larger the hospital, the greater the likelihood of errors, right?
Absolutely. And then you have hospital-acquired infections. They wouldn't exist if hospitals were perfect.
Yeah, well, we know that they're not. Anyway, it looks like we have to take another short break. And when we come back, we want to just talk more about these issues.
You're listening to the Business of Medicine on TalkZone.com. Back to Sharon Hollander.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us. We're in communication today with Gary Vautour. And one of the things that, Gary, you'd mentioned before we went on break was that, you know, now with Obamacare and all the changes in healthcare, it's even more important to have patient advocates than before. So how would you characterize the significance of politics in your field?
Well, politics are always present in healthcare, whether or not people realize it or not. The Medicare system has been shaped by political forces throughout decades. The prescription drug coverages that people have now under Medicare are a result of a president who wanted to be reelected, passing what made him look popular. There was tons of politics that went behind that, that in the years following the decision to create Part D, people went to jail for what was done in order to pass it because of ethical violations that they made and downright dishonest statements that were made to Congress about in order to get it passed. But that was a long time ago. It was made for different reasons. Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, is become a politically polarizing subject in this country. And one of the places that I see that happening a lot is in Medicaid expansions that were designed as part of the Affordable Care Act. The act was designed and intended to have Medicaid expand. Medicaid is the state version of Medicare.
Right.
It is for seniors and people who are disabled or blind to have health care. It's a into out of their taxes. That's why it's called an entitlement. And it's designed to give you health care after you're 65 or if you become disabled or become blind. Medicaid is the state program that is run by the 50 states, and it's designed to provide health care for people who are poor as well as those other people if they are poor. So somebody who's on disability insurance and gets Medicaid, Medicare will probably be eligible to get Medicaid as well. Well, in order to cover more and more people, the Affordable Care Act is designed to bring health care coverage to every single person in this country. There's a lot of good reasons to do that that we can't go into because that takes another hour completely.
Right.
A big part of it is the reductions in charity care that hospitals have to provide. Right now, when somebody walks into an emergency room and they're sick, a hospital has to provide care to them, whether they can afford it or not. The fact when they can't afford that care and they receive that care, the hospital has to shift that cost somewhere else. They're not going to take it out of their profit. They shift that cost to people who self-pay and to the people who have insurance. So indirectly, charity care raises the premiums that health care insurances have to charge people. It's covered by the whole, whether we wanted to or not. The idea behind the Affordable Care Act was to shift that and make it more out in the open. So by cutting some of the things in Medicare and making it more accountable, tightening up a lot of the payment systems, not paying for recurring errors at hospitals, for example, readmissions are going to be much more difficult for them to get money for under Medicare's new rules. Those cost savings were going to be sunk back into Medicaid programs in all 50 states to increase the number of people that receive Medicaid. Right now, in most states, the determiner for somebody who is poor is the poverty level. If you're at 100% of poverty level, which is about $12,000 or below, you're eligible to get Medicaid. If you're above that, you're not. That's for a single person household with no disability, no blindness, and under 65 and no children. Those rules change when all those other factors come into it. We'll stick with that for a second. Because the Affordable Care Act was designed to improve that, and it was going to increase it from 100 to 140%, so that people making $16,000 a year would be able to get Medicaid. The Fed said, we'll have the states do this. We'll provide the funding for the first 3 years. After that, the states will have to pick up 10% of the cost on their own, these new enrollees. That will help us not have to provide so many subsidies for people who are in the lower income levels to get them to get health care. So the Affordable Care Act was written that you're eligible for subsidies getting your health care premiums paid from the federal government if you make 140% or more of the federal poverty level. It created a gap because what happened is many of the states went to the Supreme Court and said, this isn't constitutional. The feds can't force us to do this, even though it's their money and they're paying the bill. And the Supreme Court decided that in that specific part of the Affordable Care Act, the states were correct, that this was a states' rights issue, and they gave the states the ability to say no to expanding Medicaid. 26 of our 51 states, 50 in Washington, D.C., have said no to expanding Medicaid. So in those states, which are mostly in the South and in the Great Plains, where there are large numbers of poor people who need Medicaid, in order to get health insurance that will meet the eligibility requirements of the Affordable Care Act, if your income is between 100 and 140%, you can't get a subsidy. But if you're at 140% and up, you can get subsidies from the federal government to pay for your health care, which at face value is insane.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Somebody who gets $17,000 a year can get their health care subsidized by the feds, but if you make $16,000, you can't.
You can't, yeah.
Because the Affordable Care Act was written to kick in at 140%, assuming that the states would fill that gap with their Medicaid expansions. They can't go back and change that level of 140%. And the 26 states, for whatever their political reasons are creating a situation now, if you make between 100 and 140% of the federal poverty level, you can't get Medicaid and you can't get health insurance. See, that's short-sighted to me. And this is where my advocacy hat gets much bigger. You know, I advocate for those people now, too, in my mind. Because having health insurance is something that benefits every single person in this country. It lets us detect preventable illnesses before they become very expensive. It lets us give people preventative care before they become sick. Ultimately, when somebody becomes sick, we all pay the cost of their illness because they go to the emergency rooms. No hospital is going to turn them away, or they go to charity hospitals. And these costs are all shifted back onto us anyway in the forms of higher premiums and costs for everyone who does have health care. So when people say, oh, it's socialist medicine, it's not. You know, it really just... It's dragging it out from where it's been hidden and exposing it to the light of day, calling it what it is, and it's called health care for the common good. Health care is something that everyone in this country has a right to. And at this point, we've got a situation where...
Well, it's broken.
4.8 million people in this country are falling in that gap in those 26 states. It's almost 5 million people that are between 100% and 140% that should be eligible for Medicaid. But if they lived in one of the other 24 states, they'd have Medicaid.
And so they should just start moving around from state to state.
Well, the other thing is it's going to make hospitals second guess whether or not to locate in those states because they're going to have to provide charity care.
I mean, does South Carolina have what we have in California, which is the tobacco tax, where they take the money from the cigarettes and pay for health care?
We have taxes in South Carolina. We have state, federal, state, county, and city taxes, and I've lost track of what's what. We have a penny tax on every dollar that's supposed to improve the roadways within the city. You know, it's just rarely do taxes go where they're intended to go when the law was passed, you know?
Yeah. So do you have any aspirations to go into politics, fix all these problems?
No. What I'm doing is I write about it. You know, I write on NerdWall. I write on my own blog. I discuss it with as many people as possible and try to explain it so that people understand. I really believe that the key to understanding this stuff is understanding the reasons people make decisions and speaking out. You know, it's just like transparency in medicine is a very important issue to me. I believe that every single time an error is made, that error needs to be told to the patient if it in any way harmed the patient. I don't care if they, you know, the error is we forgot to wash the floor that day. You know, that's as long as the patient didn't slip and fall on that floor, I don't care. But, and that doesn't happen yet, you know. But it is happening.
Do you have a place that if patients or listeners from my listening audience, a best way for them to get in touch with you if they have specific questions or they want to read your blog?
Yeah. Just go to fierceadvocacy.com. There's a button there. Contact me.
Okay.
An email. The blog is linked off of that. There's like 20 or 30 entries in that blog that go back through the last few years of these thoughts of mine and the things that are important. A lot of them are calls to action. You know, I speak about things like spousal caregivers when they need supports, you know, that type of thing. Or hospice care, whether or not there's hope in hospice care. You know,
well, I want to thank you. I want to thank you very much for being our guest today. We're out of time, so we have to sign off. You're listening to Sharon Hollander on TalkZone.com.